U.S. factory activity slowed.
Based on hitting a shareholder value as market capitalization.
A lot more global. So creating more programming not only for, you know, us here in the English-speaking U.S.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And welcome to Friday afternoon. It's the chilly afternoon. If it's not where you are now, it will be soon. You heard Dave Schwann give the forecast. There's the temperatures drop, a freeze warning out west tonight. And that's bad news for the food trucks, I would imagine. All summer long, people have been lining up at lunchtime downtown to get their lunch from a food truck. Well, one of the food truck drivers has been fighting. Actually, I think probably a number of them have been fighting the city ordinances, but one of them filed a motion with the Supreme Court. We're going to touch on that in just a second. Also, the marijuana law came with a provision that would help with social equity, so those in disadvantaged neighborhoods might have a leg up when it comes from profiting from selling the drugs. We're going to talk to an incubator who is helping people in those neighborhoods get their businesses up and running. It's called Growmentum, and they'll be along a little bit later. Also, we'll take a look. Oh, I know. So, you know, yesterday we talked about the Kindle, the kid Kindle, how they were making it now one specific for children. We're going to talk to a childhood education expert. Lisa Guernsey is director of teaching, learning, and technology at the New American Group. It's a think tank, a lobbying group in Washington, nonpartisan, and we'll talk a little bit about managing kids in the digital age. But on the phone line now is Alexia Elejalde Ruiz. She's a writer for the Chicago Tribune, and she's been covering this food truck story. Alexia, welcome to the Biz Lunch.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, so what's your favorite food truck? Where's your go-to spot?
Oh, gosh. So we just recently started getting some on our at work, just outside of our doors. And I like the taco. The taco trucks are always welcome. Right. The jambalaya trucks I like. I don't remember the names of any. It's like the war. I'm sorry. I'm a terrible, not very good loyal food truck consumer.
But that's kind of a good point, because how much I guess there is loyalty when it comes to the food trucks. But part of the beauty of them is that they're always moving around, shaking around. So you would have different choices from day to day.
Yeah, so people like about them is that variety, right? Like, so sometimes you want to have something spicy, and sometimes you want to have something Italian, and you can, change it up without having to go very far.
It's pretty hard for me to believe that it's been 7 years now since they've been up and running. That long or a little longer?
Oh, they've been up longer than that. It's been 7 years since the city came out with new regulations again on food trucks, because that's kind of when it started to explode in popularity.
And so the regulations have to do mostly, well, I know there's regulations certainly about sanitariness and things like that, but it's also having to do with protecting existing businesses, right? Brick and mortar restaurants.
Yeah, so some of the rules that some of the food trucks have been concerned about involve, for example, they can't park within 200 feet of any establishment that serves food. So that can be a restaurant, it can be a 7-Eleven with hot dog rollers. And then also there's time restrictions for how long they can stay parked somewhere. And they also are required to carry GPS devices in their trucks so that the city can see where they are at any given time.
And that brings us to Laura Pekarik, who is the owner of Cupcakes for Courage. I'll just assume from looking at her truck and her gear that part of her profits go to breast cancer research. At least that's what it looks like.
Yeah, exactly. She founded her business kind of as a charity after a personal experience with cancer.
And so she filed suit against the city, right? Was she the only one?
At the time, she had another co-defendant. A co-plaintiff back when she first filed it. But he went out of business. He was the schnitzel king back when. Back when they filed it 7 years ago. But he has since left the city, so she's the only one left standing, fighting the city on its rules.
It's funny, you know. We go to Bridgeport for the White Sox games from time to time, and there's a big billboard or a painting on the back of a garage, I think, for the schnitzel king. I had no idea it was a food truck.
Yeah, well, once upon a time it was.
Okay, so they're filing suit. They find their way up the court system to the state Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court ruled, they upheld this idea of 200 feet from a restaurant, right?
Yeah, so every step along the way, Laura's case, the court decided against her and in favor of the city. So the most recent one in May was the state Supreme Court that held that the city's rules, the 200-foot rule, was constitutional, and also that the GPS rule was constitutional, which were the two main ones that Laura was fighting.
And so when it comes to the GPS rule, the idea is the city says you have to have be in GPS contact with regulators so that they can check on you, make sure that you aren't 200 feet from a restaurant, and make sure that you are moving from time to time. Okay, so Laura gives up on the fight about the 200 feet, it sounds like, but she takes the GPS part to the U.S. Supreme Court. Why one and not the other?
Well, because the 200-foot rule, which is the one that, you know, a lot of food trucks are really frustrated by because it limits where they can be,
right.
That was decided by the state Supreme Court under state law. And so to go to the Supreme Court, it has to be
Some sort of federal argument, right.
So for the GPS rule, it was based on the argument had been challenging its Fourth Amendment violation. And so the state Supreme Court had said that it's okay because, you know, the city can use it for health inspections, you know, so it's kind of like in the best interest. And her lawyers are, so basically they're challenging it as a Fourth Amendment violation at the Supreme Court.
Because
that's the protection against unwarranted searches and seizures.
Right, so the idea is that the government is always following you because of this regulation, and that's a violation of their civil rights. This case was taken on not by an Illinois lawyer, it looks like, but by a libertarian group in Washington, D.C.?
That's right. The Institute for Justice, you know, as a libertarian group, you know, they're very concerned about, you know, free competition and not, you know, government interference. And so this was obviously something that they were interested in.
I mean, part of the argument they make, at least in your article, is that if they can follow Laura around or require that she wear GPS or have it on her truck. I've got a licensed business in Illinois. They might one day require that I affix GPS to my business.
Yeah, he's making kind of a slippery slope argument that this opens up the ability of governments to, you know, to monitor businesses by requiring it as part of the licensure,
but
that they can require. Yeah,
there is a little logical difference though between a mobile food truck than a fixed McDonald's franchise, right? I mean, you can see why they might need GPS to keep track of them.
Right, and that's what the city said. You know, for health inspections, for example, they need to know where they are. They were also at some point were saying that it's helpful for us to keep a database so that we can let the public know where they are potentially.
Yeah, I don't buy that one. That doesn't seem quite right for me. Okay, so the Supreme Court they filed with the Supreme Court. We don't know yet whether the Supreme Court's going to take this case, right?
That's right. And the city did something called they waived their response, which means that they have so little confidence that the Supreme Court is going to take this that they said, we're not even going to respond to it. And they don't have to unless one of the justices on the Supreme Court asks them to respond. And so, yeah, it'll take months before the Supreme Court says whether or not they plan to take the case.
I mean, I know you're not in the business of handicapping lawsuits, but what are her chances?
I have no idea. I don't want to guess, but I mean, she has lost the prior three, you know, at the local and state level. So I don't know. I don't know. I mean, it may be, I do not want to even guess.
Right. So,
but, you know, yeah.
Well, right. So her batting average so far has not been so good.
Right. Exactly.
Part of the argument they make, too, and you mentioned that her partner in the lawsuit went out of business, is that this sort of regulation has stifled the food truck industry in Chicago in ways that the food truck industry around the country hasn't been stifled. Is there evidence of that?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a group locally, an Illinois Food Truck Association, that tracks how many food trucks there are active, and they say that it's like half of what it had been back in 2012 before the city implemented its new regulations. And there was a Chamber of Commerce or a Chamber of Commerce Foundation report that ranked cities based on how friendly they are to food trucks, and Chicago was way down on the list having very burdensome regulations.
Laura is not driving the streets now, but the truck still Cupcakes for Courage is at food festivals and places like that. Alexia Elejalde Ruiz writes about this in the Chicago Tribune. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
It's 12:22. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank. Okay, so, you know, the marijuana laws take effect on January 1st, and one of the ways they pushed this, one of the benefits the proponents argued was that there could be a social equity part of this, that the people who had been hurt perhaps by the war on drugs could benefit by the sale of drugs. There's an accelerator in a town called Gromentum. It's a cannabis business accelerator. I first learned of it from Wendy Esger, who works on it. And they've got a series of events coming up this fall to help businesses. And here to talk about that is Bruce Montgomery on the phone line. Bruce, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Steve, thank you so much, and glad to be here this afternoon.
Yeah, so I had a lot of questions, not a lot of time. Tell me first about the social equity component of the law and why it's important.
Well, Illinois is the 11th state to legalize the adult use of cannabis, and in order to right the wrongs, as you mentioned, of the past and reflects Illinois' diverse population, the law emphasizes something called social equity, and this is designed to create a social equity opportunity for those communities that have been ravaged by the war on drugs. Now, just because these communities have had this kind of challenge doesn't mean that there's not an entrepreneurial zest that exists within every neighborhood. And so when you look at the South Side and the West Sides of Chicago, some of the best and well-known entrepreneurs in the planet have come from these communities. So this is an opportunity to reach out in those communities and take advantage of that kind of talent and skill and drive and looking at this opportunity as an industry at the ground floor. And this opportunity, a window of opportunity, probably will not come around again.
So, Bruce, what will the people who take these, start these businesses do? Are we talking about sales forces, or, I mean, business selling pot? I don't know what other peripheral sort of jobs there might be.
Well, I'm so glad you made that point, because this is an industry, and all industries have an ecosystem. They need security. They need IT. They need transportation, distribution, and logistics. They need marketing. You know, this is an agricultural product. When you talk about hemp and cannabis, you're talking about something that can be grown, and a lot of people can grow it in great volume. So what's going to make the difference in the marketplace? Well, that's where branding and marketing come in. That's where customer service comes in. You know, so there are many ways that people can be involved in this industry, and the idea of having Gromentum Lab, an accelerator dedicated to creating equity opportunities, not just in the retail area or in the cannabis marketing, but in many, many other areas where they have a chance to have successful businesses that make it a start in this industry and go on to serve other industries as well.
So there might be a limited number of dispensary licenses, but there are an unlimited number of opportunities around those licenses.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, the dispensary is just going to be one of the aspects. We've had medical dispensaries in Illinois for a couple of years now, and each of those medical dispensaries are going to be grandfathered into the recreational program. And as the mayor and the governor and others take a look at how to equitably make opportunities across the entire state and the city, we have to look at, again, what's behind the scenes. You know, I've seen some marvelous companies in the brief time that I've been focusing on this industry. My background is teaching entrepreneurs to be successful in no matter what kind of business. And I spent most of my adult life in the technology arena. And I've seen that industry adapt in ways that we never could have imagined 25 years ago. And so the same thing is going to happen here. There are going to be front office and back office kinds of opportunities. And again, our hope is to help people through an accelerator process, which really brings together something that, unfortunately, my previous industry in IT and technology didn't do, and that is provide the mentoring, the coaching, and the capital that many young entrepreneurs just don't have access to.
I know you've got some events coming up, so how do people find out more information and find out what opportunities they might find through Gromentum?
Well, we have a wonderful workshop that we're going to have on October 26th. It's going to be at Olive Harvey College on the South Side of Chicago. We're so happy that the City College of Chicago have brought us in and said, look, we want to make opportunities not only for entrepreneurs, but for workforce development. So the first thing that we're doing is going to be October 26th at Olive Harvey College on the South Side of Chicago. And all people have to do is go to Gromentum Lab. That's GROMENTUMLAB.com, and you can register, you can sign up for our ongoing newsletter, you can find out about what an accelerator actually is and what an accelerator actually does. And if you're listening to this show and you're a mentor or you're somebody who can add value and say, look, I want to help some entrepreneurs get a leg up, certainly we're looking for those kinds of relationships too.
You know, we are going through some transformative period in the state when it comes to legalized betting, legalized marijuana, all of that. There certainly are opportunities for growth, and Bruce Montgomery at Gromentum is helping with that. Bruce, it was great to talk to you. Thanks very much for joining us on this Friday afternoon.
Hey, this is a great show. I listen to it all the time. And, Steve, you do a great job. And thank you for having me on today.
Thank you, Dave Schwann. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. All right, what's your favorite Chicago skyscraper? There's a skyscraper group that came out with the 50 most influential skyscrapers in the country. Five of them are in Chicago. The only city with more is New York. We will talk about that a little bit later in the program. But first, education, early education. Lisa Guernsey is on a phone line here from the New America Foundation. And Lisa, welcome to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, Steve. Happy to be with you.
I'm glad you're here. I was talking yesterday. We were talking about the fact that I think it's Google is coming out with a new Kindle for kids. And my first reaction to that was, you know, that they're sort of manipulating, making money off of kids and things like that. And the more I looked at it, the more I read about it, I'm like, well, the kids have screen time anyway. If this is going to encourage reading books, it's probably not a bad thing. I know you look at kids in the digital age, and I just wonder if you like the idea of kids reading their books off of Kindle.
It's not a bad thing if they're reading.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Key,
sure.
Right? And having moments to converse about what they're reading, that's a key as well. That's what the science is showing us. So that can be done whether they're on a screen or reading from print.
So the idea is, yeah, right, you take it in, but then having meaningful conversations using your oral skills, that's where kids develop.
Exactly.
I was reading a piece you wrote in the Scientific American, and it had to do with that, and you said that the future of preschool education or the programs that are working need to focus on two things, two foundational skills, executive functioning and oral language. We'll do oral language in a second, but what is executive functioning?
No, it's a good question. It's kind of a highfalutin word for what really is a couple of skills that kids need and adults need just to be able to function in life.
Right.
So the first is it includes working memory, being able to hold an idea in your head for a little while. The second, it includes impulse control, being able to control your emotions or control your impulses. And the third piece of it is being able to flexibly move and direct your attention from one thing to another, but still being able to kind of maintain, persist with the task, finish what you've done, follow through.
Forget about
those
the kids.
Those are all pieces of executive function.
I think the adults could benefit from that.
Absolutely.
And then oral skills?
So oral language skills are often kind of forgotten about when we think about little kids and what they need to learn. We focus a lot on early literacy and making sure they know how to read, which is incredibly important. But the foundation to that is knowing how to speak, not just say words out loud, but actually have some ability to have a conversation, to listen to what's been told to you and then reflect on it and respond and then respond back and really kind of go deeper and be more complex in the way that you're responding. And these are things that children can build over time if they're given the opportunity to, instead of being told to just kind of answer yes or no.
And this is a business show, so clearly the idea is the better children do early, the better they do later, and then the better they are in the workforce and for business and for our economy.
Exactly. And there are a number of studies that show how much this matters in the long term. And in fact, there's return on investment in these types of programs that have those kinds of skill building approaches where teachers are trained to really help children develop their executive function skills, develop their oral language skills. Those kids are the ones who can do better in school, but they also are less likely to be retained, or they might need fewer remedial classes. They'll do better in terms of being able to get jobs, acquire and sustain employment, as well as stay out of, you know, the criminal justice system. So there's a whole range of benefits from really strong early education.
I have two kids. One's out of college. The other is a senior, just brought a bunch of his friends into the city for the weekend. And you know, they've done very well at school. I'm very proud of them. And I think one of the reasons is because my wife insisted when they were very young that they go to a Montessori school. And it seems to me that the Montessori program emphasizes the sorts of skills you're talking about here.
Yes, and that's one that does have some really strong studies behind it. In the Scientific American article, I write about studies on Montessori, also on approaches that involve a lot of play and in conversation and giving children choices, giving them autonomy. But what we're finding is that the Montessori method, as well as some of these others that I've noted, at their root, what they're doing is really helping children to do those things like persist in a task, gain some independence, think through what they're doing, talk with each other about what they're doing and what they want to do next. And those are the foundational skills that the kids need.
Well, I think Montessori is probably fairly widely known. I don't know about the other ones. You write about tools of the mind. What is that?
Yes, right. So that's an approach. It's around the country now, but it's still relatively new. It uses an approach that includes pretend play, but instead of just having children kind of go off in a corner and put on costumes or pretend that they're a fireman, the children are encouraged to talk first about what they're going to do, to plan out, and to talk together and say, okay, if you're going to be the fireman, then I want to be the dog that's, you know, stuck in the upstairs window, and if you're going to be the dog, then when do I get to be the cat? Right. And those kinds of experiences and that conversation leads children then to really think about each other, have some understanding of what it means to have to hold a function in their head, that they're going to role play for a little while, and they're going to have to play this particular role. Then they go and play it.
That sounds like a lot of fun. That sounds like executive function, right? That's what you were talking about earlier.
Exactly. Yeah. And then there's oral language, because they're asked to, in peer-to-peer conversations, really talk about what they're going to do and plan it out together.
And that's tools of the mind. Are there others that are up and coming?
Yeah, another one that is actually an older model, but is still very much in use, is called High Scope. And it has a process called Plan, Do, Review. And it's been used in some of in what's known as the Perry Preschool Study, which has the longest term effects we've seen up to, you know, adulthood. We're still seeing the good effects of that program. And in High Scope, children are asked to plan what they want to do next, to then go ahead and do that. Maybe they've chosen to, like, go to the block section and build a tower, and then come back and review what they've done. Talk about why they built that tower, how big did it get, why it fell over. And those kinds of strategies and that sequencing has been shown to be helping children as well.
You know, we started talking about the Amazon Kindle, and you wrote about Jeff Bezos, who actually is investing $1 billion in childhood education.
To do. About a year ago on Twitter, he announced that he would be investing in early childhood education, Montessori-inspired models for low-income families. And he's also been saying that he'll be investing in homeless families as well. We have yet to see what that's going to look like. And there's a lot of people who are quite interested in making sure that whatever he does invest in, it's based on the best science and really can help those kids who most.
And he was
according to what we're learning.
And he was a Montessori kid, right? So he's sort of going to base
was.
It on it. Yeah. Okay.
So I think that had a real effect on him.
Bezos aside, how are we doing when it comes to investing in these programs in our young kids?
Well, unfortunately, we're still very far behind most other countries. We have about, depending on how you count it, but some numbers from the National Institute of Early Education Research show that we have around 40% of children in a public, that have access to a public pre-K program for 4-year-olds. It really depends on the state that you live in. Many states don't have anywhere near 40% of their children having access to that. We do have some help with our Head Start programs that have some really good outcomes for young children, but those are only available to children in the very, very poorest families or that are foster children or homeless. And so they're maybe not available to families that are just right above the poverty line.
Lisa Guernsey from the New America Foundation. Lisa, it was great to talk to you. I appreciate it. I hope we can do it again soon.
Thanks for having me on, Steve.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. I think it's safe to say most of us have had dreams of living downtown and enjoying the city for all that it's worth at one point in our lives. The problem is that it's quite expensive, but something in the residential real estate space might help ease those financial stresses. Co-living. It's something you may or may not have heard of, but it's gaining traction in the city. You get to enjoy much of your own living space, like bedrooms and bathrooms, but you might share a kitchen space with 2 or 3 other residents. CityPads is creating one of these co-living spaces on the top 30 floors of the Clark Adams Building downtown. They're shooting for over 500 units to rent, so plenty for those who want to try out that city living. But they've got some building to do, so that'll be in the future, along with flying electric cars, because Porsche and Boeing are teaming up to explore not just flying cars,
electric flying cars.
Porsche is quoted as saying that this is the third dimension of travel, and they're very interested in it.
And if my first time flying in a car is going to be in a Porsche, I'd be okay with that. So let's keep our fingers crossed, people. This could be cool. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thanks very much, Orion Samuelson. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Albie Galoon is joining us from the newsroom at Crane Chicago Business. And we'll look up, Albie. What's your favorite skyscraper?
Oh, I was afraid you were going to ask me that question. That's kind of like asking me which child is my favorite.
Well, the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat, and I did not know they existed until I read your story, is apparently celebrating its 50th anniversary, and they've come out with the 50 most influential skyscrapers in the U.S.?
That's correct. Actually, 50 most influential tall buildings in the entire world.
Okay. Oh, Chicago does pretty well.
Chicago does. Chicago has 5 on the list, and the only city with more is New York with 6. So, Chicago obviously has a reputation as being an innovator in architecture that goes, all the way back to the mid-1880s when the first skyscraper at 10 stories was built here.
I'm so glad you went there, Albie, because I read that, and I'm reading your story about the home insurance building, Adams and LaSalle, which was eventually torn down, right?
Correct.
Now, I always thought that the Monadnock building was the first skyscraper, but I guess I've been wrong my whole life.
This is the one, and it was a big deal because it was built with a steel structure. So the skeleton of the building was steel, and so that made it possible to go higher. And that was a real kind of milestone in terms of high-rise construction, if that's what we could call it at that point.
Well, it was at that point. And so when you look at the Chicago buildings on the list, I don't think there are really any surprises, right? There's the Willis Tower. I'm still calling it the John Hancock Center until it gets a new name. The 333 East Wacker building.
West Wacker,
I'm sorry. Right. Aqua Tower, which is just right here, right by me, and IBM Plaza. So those are the 5. I guess, Willis, it's clear why that would stand out. Why is it that the 333 West Wacker stands out? It's a beautiful building right on the corner of the river. What's its distinction?
Well, it is, and it's one of those buildings that, it's not super tall on the skyline.
Right.
And, you don't really notice it. It's one of the favorites of the river tour guides.
Right, amateur photographers, because we all take our pictures with the reflection, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it was, it was really considered to be the first postmodern skyscraper in Chicago when it was built in 1983. And, I think for people in the architecture world, it kind of was a great way of incorporating the bend of the river into the building, and I think that was, to a lot of people, was pretty cool.
So, we're talking about buildings, though, the most recent built one, it would have been Aqua not too long ago, but for the most part, the older skyscrapers in town, and we're doing that in a period where there are a lot of new skyscrapers being built or just around the corner.
We are, actually. It's interesting. We're kind of in a renaissance of super tall building in Chicago. There are a couple that are just kind of wrapping up construction. One of them is NEMA Chicago, which is a big apartment building in the South Loop at the south end of Grant Park. Another one is right in the Lakeshore East development. It's the Vista Tower.
Yeah, I could reach out and touch it, Albie, from where I am.
I'm sure you could. And so that one is topped out. And that actually is designed by Jeannie Gang, who's a Chicago architect. She was the architect who designed Aqua Tower, which is on the list. So,
right.
And then we've got a few more that are coming out of the ground right now. And so we will actually, one of them is actually could be the tallest skyscraper in Chicago if it's built right next to the Tribune Tower.
Oh, right. And I saw the proposals for that. But a lot of times, we've got about 30 seconds here, a lot of times the proposals, the big buildings on paper, don't always make it to the ground.
That's true. I mean, it really depends on market conditions, and obviously you got to get the city's approval, too. So you got to run the city council gauntlet, and then you know, you got to go out and get your construction financing. And, you know, we are at the late stage of a very strong real estate cycle. So it's unclear whether some of these projects that have yet to come out of the ground will get their financing before the market turns.
Check out Albie's story. It is at chicagobusiness.com. Albie Galoon, thanks very much for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Steve.